From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. Later today, President Trump heads to Louisiana for a rally in that state's governor's race, where in addition to campaigning, it's expected he'll rail against the impeachment inquiry that is underway in the House. Lawmakers are preparing for day two of public testimony tomorrow. Joining us now is Tim Mak, NPR national security and politics reporter. Tim, the big revelation yesterday was that Ambassador William Taylor revealed that an aide had overheard Trump appointee EU Ambassador Gordon Sondland on the phone with President Trump talking in a Kiev restaurant about the investigations that Trump wanted in Ukraine involving Democrats. Why do Democrats think that that phone call is such an important development?
Well, it indicates the extent to which the president was personally involved, that he was a primary driver of this effort. I mean, Taylor testified that not only did Trump ask about the investigations, but that Sondland responded to the president saying that the Ukrainians were willing to move forward on them. There has been some reporting on a Republican strategy to kind of insulate the president from this impeachment inquiry by saying that many of the actions were taken by individuals who were freelancing or acting without the president's direction. Now, this testimony undercuts that argument, right, and establishes, if true, the president as a central player. That's why on Friday, the House Intelligence Committee will be interviewing David Holmes. He's a State Department official who was the Taylor aide who overheard the conversation, and that interview will be behind closed doors.
Mm-hmm. Unlike the testimony of Marie Yovanovitch, will be out in the open tomorrow.
Let's
listen to Tennessee Republican Mark Green on CNN this morning dismissing that revelation about the phone call that came out of the Taylor testimony yesterday.
It's just ridiculous that this is the best they got. Yesterday was the best they got, and it was an overheard phone conversation at a restaurant. That's crazy.
So, again, Republicans saying this is, you know, an overheard phone call, secondhand information. Is this how they're going to play that revelation?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Republicans have really had some issues with the procedures of the impeachment inquiry. They've really focused on arguing about the credibility of witnesses and arguing that witnesses were not, for example, in a position to witness firsthand the things that they are alleging broadly.
Republicans say witnesses so far only have hearsay evidence, but the White House is preventing witnesses with firsthand information from testifying, including acting White House Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney. Can Democrats compel him to testify?
Well, Democrats could pursue subpoenas in the courts and legal action, but they've generally decided not to do that or make that a primary focus. I mean, given the schedule of the impeachment inquiry, they've decided to mark down refusal to testify as evidence of obstruction for possible articles of impeachment and not to pursue lengthy court battles, which could take months or even years to decide. I mean, this kind of all gets back to this whole secondhand argument. As you pointed out, Mick Mulvaney has declined to testify. The argument by Republicans is that the witnesses who testified Wednesday or other witnesses that will appear before the committee have never met the president and are only testifying about what they observed far from the Oval Office. Mm-hmm. And Democrats respond that the witnesses were observing firsthand the effects of the effort set in motion by the president and his aides, and that those who could testify as firsthand witnesses to the president's actions themselves have refused to testify.
Nancy Pelosi, the Speaker of the House, held a press conference today. Let's listen to a little bit of what she had to say.
What I am saying the president has admitted to and says it's perfect. I said it's perfectly wrong. It's bribery.
She says it's bribery. Now, that is a word we've been hearing more from senior Democrats. That is one of the things in the Constitution you can be impeached for. I went back to find the line in the Constitution. It says the president, vice president, and all civil officers of the United States shall be removed from office on impeachment for and conviction of treason, bribery, or other high crimes and misdemeanors. So is bribery seen by Democrats as an easier sell for impeachment than other high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, yeah. I mean, the Constitution doesn't exactly outline what specifically high crimes and misdemeanors actually means. And it does seem like Democrats going forward, will argue that this whole impeachment inquiry revolves around whether withholding military aid for Ukrainian investigations constitutes this bribery that's explicitly mentioned in the Constitution. Nancy Pelosi, as you cited, laid out this case, and House Intelligence Committee Chairman Adam Schiff has also said that bribery is a possible article of impeachment.
Finally, just briefly, what are you expecting to hear from Marie Yovanovitch, the former Ukraine ambassador, tomorrow in public testimony?
You know, Democrats have argued that she's the first victim of the president's effort to leverage U.S. foreign policy for personal gain. Evidence has emerged over the course of this investigation of a campaign of disinformation used by some of the president's associates to have her removed from office. Republicans will say, hey, she doesn't have firsthand knowledge of the president's efforts.
Tim Mak at NPR, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Now to the 2020 presidential race. Former Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick has announced he's throwing his hat into the ring. That means the crowded field, which had just begun to shrink, has now ticked back up to 18 Democrats. This announcement comes as former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg mulls over a late bid for the nomination. For more, WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks joins us from Boston. Hi, Anthony.
Hi, Tanya.
So remind us, outside of Massachusetts, who is Deval Patrick and why is he getting into the race so late?
Well, Deval Patrick served as governor of Massachusetts for two terms. He succeeded Mitt Romney in 2007. He grew up poor on Chicago's South Side. He's a close friend of former President Barack Obama and was the state's first African-American governor and only the second in the nation. After he left the governor's office, he went to work for Bain Capital in Boston. And as to why he's running, I think there's an unsettled quality to the Democratic race right now. Some Democrats who want a moderate are worried that Joe Biden isn't strong enough to win the nomination. Others are worried that Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders are just too far to the left. So Patrick thinks there's room for someone like him to unite liberals, moderates, and African-American voters, a key constituency in the Democratic Party.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk a little bit about his pitch to voters. Here he is on CBS This Morning.
I want to be clear. I'm getting in because I think there is an opportunity right now for big ideas as big as the challenges we face and in the crafting and development of those ideas to bring us together.
You mentioned he feels there is an opening, but break this down for us. Where does Patrick fall ideologically when you compare him to the others on the Democratic primary field, especially frontrunners like Joe Biden and Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, even Pete Buttigieg?
Right. So Patrick's an interesting politician who's not easy to pigeonhole. I mean, he's certainly a liberal, but he's not on the far left of the party like Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders. And in fact, progressives will probably make much of the fact that he's been working for Bain Capital over the last few years, a venture capital firm founded by Mitt Romney. So that will certainly raise concerns with them. But his greatest strength is probably his oratory powers. He can give truly inspiring speeches, and he has a life story, you know, that took him from Chicago's South Side to governor of Massachusetts that really embodies the American dream. So I think he will come across as someone who can sort of – he talks about injecting empathy into the political conversation and really appealing to the better angels of people's characters. And I think we're going to hear a lot of that kind of language from him.
Sounds familiar. Sounds a lot like Obama.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I noted, he and Obama are very close. And in fact, a lot of the folks that worked on his gubernatorial campaigns also worked on Obama's presidential campaigns. So they have kind of moved back and forth between the two men.
Let's talk a little bit about strategy for a minute. He cannot participate in next week's debate. He probably won't qualify for the December debate. He's months behind the other candidates who have been campaigning for quite a while. What chance does he have to stand out, do you think?
Well, honestly, this represents a big, big challenge. And even he admits that, you know. And those close to him say this is a long shot. But then again, they say all presidential bids are long shots. Among the challenges, though, that he's facing, a number of his longtime aides are already committed to other candidates. He'll need to raise a lot of money really fast, and he'll be up against candidates who have been on the ground for months and who have extensive campaigns set up in the early vote in the states that vote early. And finally, he's dealing with a really compressed schedule with less than 3 months to go before the Iowa caucuses, the New Hampshire primary, then comes Nevada, South Carolina, then Super Tuesday. That's not a lot of time to get his message and his face before millions of voters.
A bigger question, looking at the landscape, though, I mean, does he dilute or thin out the support for any one Democratic candidate? I mean, I'm thinking, is this something the Democrats should be worried about?
Well, that's an interesting question. I mean, some of the conventional wisdom suggests that, you know, he's going to appeal to more moderates. So maybe he takes votes away from Joe Biden, maybe even takes votes away from someone like Pete Buttigieg, who has sort of emerged as the young upstart moderate, an alternative to Joe Biden. Deval Patrick could certainly dilute some of their support. But again, I think that's putting the cart before the horse, because I think what he first has to prove is, does he really have the means, the wherewithal to make a meaning, to make any meaningful impact on this campaign? And we're just going to have to see that. But it's certainly a big challenge that he's facing.
That's WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Thank you so much, Anthony.
It's my pleasure, Tanya.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
The third season of the Netflix show The Crown premieres Sunday. Ever since creator Peter Morgan debuted the show in 2016, it has won fans on both sides of the Atlantic. This season begins in 1964. Olivia Colman and Tobias Menzies have taken over the roles of Queen Elizabeth and her husband Prince Philip from Claire Foy and Matt Smith. In this scene, the pair discusses Harold Wilson, leader of the Labour Party, who's running in the general election.
You do know if that man wins today, the want is out.
Who?
Wilson. Half his cabinet would be made up of rabid anti-monarchists. We want our heads on spikes. Vive la Révolution. Except, I doubt they speak French in Halifax. Huddersfield, wherever he's from.
Well, joining us now from London is Tobias Menzies. Welcome.
Thanks very much.
Well, first of all, you play a character that we've all seen forever, but we don't know that much about him. Who is Prince Philip for you?
God, starting with the difficult question. I think you're right. He's quite hard to get to the bottom of. He's clearly a man, I think, from, you know, from that generation. You know, obviously saw action in the Second World War. Is a naval man. He's himself comes from, you know, a royal family, a Greek royal family. So even though people talk about him and he's in a way represented in the show as something of an outsider, he very much was to the manor born as well. I think he's a contradiction. I think he has contradictions within him. I think he's funny. I think he's emotional and yet kind of guarded and armored. He is an alpha male who has spent his life second fiddle to his wife.
Has to stand behind her, right, when she walks.
Yes, yeah. And all of that makes, I think, for quite interesting material to sort of bring to the screen.
Well, what about the relationship that he has with the Queen, especially in this season, the third season of The Crown? Because in the first two seasons, it seemed a bit like that relationship was strained, and now maybe not so much.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think Peter has taken the writing away from the sort of internal kind of challenges of their marriage and what it was for him to, I suppose, set aside his own career in order to, you know, be her consort, etc. And we see in season three, I think they've reached sort of calmer waters in terms of their marriage, and both their challenges come from outside.
How was it to step in to this role after Matt Smith played Philip for the first two seasons? Did you watch his performance at all or talk to him about his approach?
I had seen the show and admired it hugely prior to any suggestion that I might be involved in it. So, I love what Matt did in the first two seasons. I didn't talk to him about the character and doing it. I know him. We've worked together before. But yes, for some reason, I didn't feel like that I wanted to do that. And actually, the first two seasons are kind of an amazing resource anyway. It's such an unusual thing to have, such a successful, critically acclaimed show that then completely changes every
right.
single character. What could possibly go wrong? And I definitely called on what Matt had done in those first two seasons through watching it. But then I felt like, in a way, I had to then take it on myself and take it somewhere else.
Well, and the thing that came to my mind, and I don't know if this reference is going to work for you because it may just be too American, but I thought of Dick Sargent taking over for Dick York as Darren on Bewitched, where this one character has been established for so long and then somebody else just comes in and is that character.
I'm going to have to admit that I have no idea
what
you're
talking
about.
You don't know Bewitched,
about,
okay. That's fine.
But if you say so, I completely agree.
Well, okay. let's talk about the other part of your character in the season is the prince as a father. And we have a scene here with you as the Duke of Edinburgh trying to persuade your daughter Anne, played by Erin Doherty, to appear in a film about the royal family as part of a public relations push. Here it is.
I want people to like us, to feel that they know us. I know you value your privacy, but I think there's a lot about you that they would like if they got a chance. The fact that you're generally, you're good value for money.
Like a pair of long-lasting boots.
Is there anything one loves more in life than a pair of long-lasting boots?
How do you see him as a parent?
I think that's one of the things that Peter starts to draw out in this third season as the children start to come into the story. Anne, I think it seems to be quite sort of well acknowledged that it's Anne is who Philip is closest to. Charles is on record as saying that he found Philip a very difficult father to have. If you take Charles's word, it seems like he could be quite a bullying and domineering father. And yet Anne speaks very well and warmly about it. So contradiction seems to be at the heart of it.
Let's talk about you as an actor. A lot of our American listeners may know you from Game of Thrones as a Tully. And also you were in The Night Manager. You were in Rome. How is this different than those experiences?
Unlike those dramas, I'm playing someone who is a real person mm-hmm. and is still alive. So that has its certain challenges, both technical and I guess there's an element of responsibility towards that. In terms of the making of it, there are definitely similarities in terms of sort of size of budget and the kind of prestige nature of the drama that we're making.
Does it feel as prestigious as Game of Thrones or more?
Yes, definitely. It's such a different show. And I'm also much more involved in this. Game of Thrones, I adored shooting that, but I was sort of much more in and out of that. And, that's an imagined fantasy world, which I usually shot in the mud in Belfast. There's much less mud when I'm shooting The Crown. It's
You don't get dirty when you're the prince.
I don't get that dirty. The clothes are a little sharper tailored.
Let me just come back then to the royal family here. Now, you were born in England.
Yeah.
What do you think of the royal family, or what have you thought of the royal family over the course of your life?
I mean, I don't know what this means. I'll sort of be instantly fired. But the truth is, I was brought up pretty Republican, small R Republican. Mm-hmm. The royal family were not very present in our lives. They weren't people that I thought about very much. I hope my mum doesn't mind me saying, but she would actively not watch the Queen's speech on Christmas Day. Mm-hmm. I definitely, to a certain degree, quite ill qualified for this. So it was a steep learning curve in terms of thinking about them, reading about them, sort of putting my focus on who they are. I suppose, I think for me, they were just part of the infrastructure here. And I think that's not an uncommon experience for a lot of British people. But having worked on the show and you know, now found out quite a lot about them and thought about them a lot more, I've been impressed with them. And whatever you think of them politically, you can't question the level of duty and commitment to their positions.
Mm-hmm. Why do you think so many people are so interested in them? Not just to watch things like the wedding of Harry and Meghan, but to watch The Crown.
I guess because they are figureheads of our modern society. And so therefore, certain sort of mythologies and ideas of who we are as people sort of coalesce around these figures. And so I think as soon as a drama invites you to sort of go behind closed doors with those people, there's obviously a sort of, oh, I wonder if it's like that kind of frisson. I also think a lot of the success of the show is that Peter pitches that in a really brilliant way so that it doesn't fall into soap. It remains, I feel, quite a, I think at times, important and sort of cogent investigation of those institutions and what they mean and how they filter down into our sort of civic society. And for that reason, it delivers on more than one level. It both has the, oh yeah, I wonder if it is like that, and also is sort of contributing to a bigger sort of conversation about those institutions.
Was there ever a moment in recording a scene for The Crown that you guys couldn't stop laughing because of whatever you were having to say in the sort of stuffy world of the royal family?
It's always my dreaded question, like did something funny happen on set? Because my mind always goes blank. I think I would say this, that it's funny how all that besuited, gilded sort of privilege becomes quite natural quite quickly, which is obviously worrying, I would say. Yeah.
Tobias Menzies, what role would you like to play next when the prince gets too old for you and somebody else has to take the role?
I've always thought I have a walk that is a bit like a cowboy. So I think I've always quite fancied playing quite a taciturn cowboy of very few words.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we'll stay tuned for that.
Cross your fingers for me. Yeah.
That is Tobias Menzies, who stars as Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh, on the Netflix show The Crown, and season 3 premieres Sunday. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much.
I'm just glad The Crown is back because I just finished Succession and now need something new to watch. This is Here and Now.
As large parts of the country experience record cold weather, a winter snowstorm blanketed most of Vermont this week. It signals the start of another ski season in the state. For resorts, that means adding hundreds of seasonal employees. Not easy, with an aging population and low unemployment rate. So some resorts are offering generous benefits to entice workers. Vermont Public Radio's Henry Epp reports.
On a recent Saturday, department managers at Sugarbush Resort in Warren, Vermont, set up at tables inside one of the resort's pubs, ready to talk to prospective employees.
Today, I have not hired anyone. I have sat down with a few people.
That's Sean Heslin, the facilities manager at Sugarbush. He's looking to fill about 10 positions, and he says it's difficult to find Vermonters to fill those jobs when the state unemployment rate is just over 2%.
I think a lot of people have jobs. A lot of my hires do come from out of state. We have been expanding our housing programs here at Sugarbush.
Employee housing is a more recent addition to the seasonal benefits and perks at Sugarbush. It also offers free ski passes, lessons, discounted food, and daycare. Year-round employees can qualify for health insurance and a retirement plan. And the resort's HR director, Anne Marie Todd, says certain specialized jobs have even more incentives.
our snowmakers in the last 2 years. We have changed some of their benefits. They get a sign-on bonus of $200, and they also get an end-of-season bonus of $1 for each hour worked.
Todd says the resort really needs those specialized workers, but it also needs workers in every department.
I mean, basically, we have about 200 full-time year-round employees, and we go up to 1,100 in the winter.
Sugarbush isn't just facing a tight labor market. It also has competition. 45 minutes up Route 100, Stowe Mountain Resort is holding its own job fair. In the parking lot outside the event, I meet Joe Shea. He's standing by his truck, smoking a cigarette, getting ready to scope out potential jobs.
Hotel operations, possibly food and beverage.
Shea says he's worked in the service industry for years. He's doing that kind of work now at
Sugarbush.
Really?
Yep.
So what brings you to, what brings you to Stowe?
Just been there about 7 years. Change of pace.
If Shea does take a job at Stowe, he'll be in line for the standard perks. Ski passes, discounted food, but also vision, dental, and medical insurance, even as a seasonal employee. I listed some of Stowe's benefits to Wynn Smith, the owner of Sugarbush, and asked if he can compete with them.
That's very tough.
Smith notes he does offer health insurance to his full-time employees. No matter what, though, there's a limited pool of potential hires here in Vermont. And in recent years, Sugarbush has looked internationally to fill the void. Smith says the resort has brought on about 120 international employees for the season, mostly students from Central and South America.
They're only allowed to work 90 days. So we have to stagger them so they come in at our busy time. They leave really before the spring totally ends. So it's good, but it's also a challenge.
Smith says Sugarbush will keep hiring for a few more months. One deciding factor in how many employees they'll need is how much snow the resort gets this year. And Smith says some less than scientific indicators point to a long winter.
The hornets seem to be building their nests a little bit higher. The woolly caterpillars seem to be thick with black and on the nose and black, you know, on the tail.
So if you believe those signs, Smith says, the thousands of seasonal employees at Vermont ski resorts could be in for a busy season. For Here and Now, I'm Henry Yap.
The State Department is warning against travel to Bolivia as the country continues to fall into chaos. The former president, Evo Morales, resigned earlier this week amid allegations that he manipulated October election results. Morales has since fled to Mexico. In Morales's place is conservative politician Jeanine Añez Chavez, who, in a bold move, stepped forward and declared herself as the new president. Joining us now for a closer look is Professor Robert Albro, a Latin America expert whose research often took him to Bolivia in the 90s. Professor, welcome.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Professor, let's talk about this new interim president, Jeanine Añez Chavez. We know that she's a conservative legislator who once called Bolivia's indigenous rituals satanic. What else do we know about her?
Well, we don't know a great deal about her. She came into politics around 2006 and comes from a part of the country, the Beni lowland area, that has traditionally not been a stronghold of the former President Morales and his party, the Movement Toward Socialism. So she could be said to represent a kind of lowland coalition of opposition to Morales that has really not been on board with his presidency from the outset, now more than 13 years ago. And in fact, back in 2008, while I don't recall exactly what her role had been, but she was she's associated with folks who were composed something called the Media Luna, which essentially was an open civil revolt, a revolt that had to be quelled in 2008.
You mentioned the Media Luna. The Santa Cruz region also tried to secede back in 2008. Morales, though, was an extremely popular president, in part because prior to him, Bolivia had gone through five presidents in 5 years, and a lot of the politicians thought the country was ungovernable. How was he able to unify it?
Well, so Morales was, yes, a transformative leader and indeed an historically important president. And there are sort of two things one can point to that are clearly accomplishments that one would have to recognize. The first is he was the first indigenous president in the history of Bolivia, possibly in the world, and made it his purpose to work to enfranchise the majority indigenous population in that country. And that is no small legacy. That really is a tremendous accomplishment in a country for which its indigenous population has had to deal with the status of second-class citizenship until very recently. Mm-hmm. The second major accomplishment was that he was actually a quite competent economic steward. Mm-hmm. And used a great deal of the resources generated from an extractive boom from which Bolivia benefited, particularly natural gas and other types of mining resources, and plowed that back into, you know, social redistributive policies and social safety net policies that had a tremendous effect on Bolivia's most poor. Bolivia has historically been a very poor country. I believe I'm correct in saying it's still the second poorest country in the hemisphere after Haiti.
Yeah.
And so he's lifted up approximately a million people from extreme poverty into the middle class in a country of 11 million.
Right, you see that extreme poverty rates fell by half.
That's right. So that was a tremendous accomplishment. Now, how sustainable that will be over time remains to be seen, given that the extractive economy has changed dramatically in the region, not just in Bolivia. But, you know, Bolivia was projected to grow, its economy was projected to grow by a 4.2% clip this coming year. Things still looked pretty sustainable, pretty good.
Yeah. But one commentator actually wrote that if Morales hadn't tried to cling to power, we might have even considered him South America's Nelson Mandela. Can you talk a little bit about that clinging to power and the findings of the investigation that really led to Morales fleeing?
So one of the difficulties with Morales as a president and then with his political party, the MAS, is that after more than a decade in power, there had been no clear plan laid for succession. One still cannot point to a second generation of young, dynamic leadership in his party. You know, there was a certain cult of personality. Morales, I think, also began to believe in the latter half of his tenure as president, you know, that he was that unique historical change agent, and it was only he who could bring about the culmination of this broad-based social and political revolution that he had undertaken, the decolonization of the country and so forth. So because of that, he began to behave in ways that I think we can reasonably describe as anti-democratic, or at least very cavalier about the democratic process. In 2016, he sought to extend term limits. He had already served for, depending upon how you want to count it, two or three terms. Mm-hmm. The Bolivian Constitution limits presidents to two terms. He asked for a national referendum to allow term limits to be extended. He lost that referendum. But then he decided not to accept the decision of the referendum, even though it had been a national vote, and took it to the Supreme Court, who annulled the outcome, citing the fact that Morales's human rights had been violated, a strange ruling. And so this created an atmosphere going into these elections where Morales had made it clear that he was going to insist on running despite what had already been established as the will of a broad swath of the population. Then, during the election process, we have a weird irregularity where on the election night, the vote count, public vote count, was stopped for 24 hours. Then when the vote count was continued 24 hours later, Morales had, you know, miraculously just enough to avoid the runoff. This immediately touched off charges of electoral manipulation and fraud. I will say that it's not altogether clear at this late point whether such fraud has actually been perpetrated. But the perception of fraud was pretty clear. And that then began what we are now seeing, street protests.
Right. Morales has said it is a coup. We, now with the rise of this conservative politician, Jeanine Añez Chávez, I'm wondering, do you believe that Morales's former supporters will back his return to Bolivian politics? He's actually said he would come back if they requested it.
Right. I think that Morales was sincere in wanting to do what was possible to limit violence and bloodshed. And so, you know, his decision to step down, his decision to retire from the scene for the time being and seek asylum in Mexico, I think we should say that at least in part that was a motivation. But I think, you know, we have the precedent of Hugo Chavez, who, you know, was briefly deposed in a coup only to return stronger than before. I think Morales is thinking about these kinds of things and willing to bide his time, weeks, months, or longer, in the hope that he can return kind of as a hero retaking the field to restore order to Bolivia. Whether that's a realistic goal remains to be seen. I mean, he had, to a significant degree, worn out his welcome with even people who were previously Morales supporters. So it's not clear whether that is a viable strategy for him or not.
It's so tempting right now to search for a through line for all of the unrest in South America. And you have said that we might be oversimplifying things by doing that, and that a bigger issue is the new idea that a democracy that doesn't address inequality is perhaps not a legitimate democracy at all. Tell us what you mean by that.
So Bolivia, in the context of Latin America currently, it is difficult to draw a thread through all of these. I think all of the various conflicts we're seeing in places like Chile and, you know, Ecuador, Peru, in different ways, Mexico, Brazil even. One thread is the idea that there had been a bringing together of, let's call it, neoliberal economic policy with nominal liberal democracy, and that that has not resulted in the even distribution of resources across countries. Even a country with a strong economy like Chile has severe socioeconomic inequality. In Bolivia, it's been very different. The inequality has different sources historically, given the largely indigenous nature of the population. And so it really is the enfranchisement of Bolivia's indigenous peoples, dealing with, you know, urban-rural divides, providing avenues for upward mobility for a growing indigenous middle class. These are the issues that Bolivians will be struggling over in the coming months, years.
That's Professor Robert Albro, a Latin America expert from American University. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
It's pretty clear that Hunter Biden, his business partner, Devin Archer, and their legal lobbying team in America for the company Burisma, a Ukrainian-owned company, had VIP access to the top of the State Department.
Do you recognize that voice? That is John Solomon speaking on Fox News last week. He turns out to be a surprisingly important figure when it comes to Ukraine and the impeachment inquiry. That's because the president listens to what he has to say. Here he is on Fox News' Hannity back in April.
There's a pattern here of Hunter Biden being in the countries where the vice president has a foreign policy portfolio and somehow walking off with some nice paydays.
Let's bring in NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
Well, and tell us more about who this guy is and why he is so connected to the impeachment inquiry.
Well, John Solomon's a longtime investigative reporter, a known figure in Washington, known for his work for many years at the Associated Press. And he, before recent years, he would have had a reputation as an intense investigative reporter and something in some ways of a hype artist. I first wrote about him in 2002, where an independent freelance investigative journalist made some credible claims that he basically ripped off his reporting about training of some of the 2001 terrorists in the airplane attacks. But Solomon progressed at the AP. He went briefly to the Washington Post, and then he made a pivot. Went to the Washington Times, a conservative newspaper there, and joined later The Hill, where he was seen as an investigative reporter and more recently was labeled an opinion reporter as people really raised questions about the nature of some of the investigations he was offering.
Okay. And then he's more recently become very well known to President Trump and his inner circle. Here's President Trump praising Solomon in a rally in October.
John Solomon should get the Pulitzer Prize. How about these fraudulent writers at the New York Times? They get Pulitzer Prize and they got it all wrong. They have to give back their Pulitzer Prize, but that's a fix also, isn't it, huh?
So he's saying that John Solomon should get a Pulitzer Prize. How much influence has Solomon had on President Trump's White House?
Well, you've certainly seen the rhetoric, some of the clips that you played just a moment or two ago from Solomon. In some ways could have come out of the president's mouth as well. The focus on Hunter Biden, the focus on his role in the corporate board of Burisma over there. And look, I think the vice president, the former vice president Joe Biden and his relations, it's very much fair game to look and scrutinize these things, both in terms of Biden being a former vice president some years ago and in terms of him being a contender for the Democratic nomination. But it's very different than saying that that's the cause for all these things we've been looking at in terms of the president's involvement, phone calls to the president of Ukraine and the like. And John Solomon's approach to this has been this is the fundamental corruption that's happening in Ukraine. It really has much to do with interference there by people on behalf of Democrats to protect them from the Bidens and similar things that sort of deflect away from a lot of the matters that are under investigation right now.
And one of the people in the president's inner circle who's been at the center of everything to do with Ukraine is Rudolph Giuliani. Here is Giuliani speaking on Hannity last month, and you'll notice that in this clip he also mentions John Solomon.
The Ukrainians brought me substantial evidence of Ukrainian collusion with Hillary Clinton, the DNC, George Soros. They came and gave me testimony. Eventually, it was John Solomon, who should get a Pulitzer Prize, by the way, put them all on tape. So it's all memorialized on videotapes.
So again, a call for Solomon to get the Pulitzer Prize. How closely has Solomon's reporting aligned with Giuliani's aims in Ukraine?
Well, it would appear to have dovetailed perfectly. Giuliani has told other reporters that he gave a lot of the materials that folks that he was involved with to Solomon for his reporting. You know, among the people Solomon talked relied on for sources was a guy named Lev Parnas, is Ukrainian-born, came to this country apparently, according to the New Yorker, early in his life, was selling or renting out Trump properties when he was a young man in Brooklyn, and yet has gone back and helped them develop damaging material on not only Hunter Biden but a former ambassador there, Mary Jovanovich, Jovanovich, and claiming that she had tried to order the chief prosecutor of the Ukraine not to prosecute certain figures. That's a claim that the State Department under President Trump has called an absolute fabrication, and that prosecutor has since backed off those things. But you've got this sort of orbit of people around Giuliani with whom Solomon has been working closely. And I want to be clear, among the people Giuliani's relied on is this husband and wife a legal team, Joe DiGenova, his wife, Victoria Tensing, who both former federal lawyers, but both of them also represent not only John Solomon personally, but they represent a Ukrainian billionaire who's been at the center of some of this scandal and has been feeding some of this damaging material out to the West.
And when you look at John Solomon in particular, does he look like the chicken or the egg? I mean, is the information coming from him going to the White House, or is he just going on Fox News and parroting the things that the White House has already got in their heads?
I'm sure he's having real conversations with people, and I'm sure he's putting it out there. But what he's doing, it would seem – the most cynical way to look at it is what he's doing is sculpting the raw material that Giuliani and his orbit have come up with mm-hmm. and putting into a journalistic frame and construct. He may believe that he's doing real journalism at his site. He's left the Hill newspaper, and its site is called John Solomon Reports, and he says reporting the truth. It is certainly a truth that Donald Trump wants to hear. It is certainly reinforcing Trump's own predilections, but it is also – steering him astray from the matter right in front of him right now happening in Washington with the impeachment hearings. It's a very different topic than the one under investigation.
NPR's David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. This is Here and Now.